that gave a form to the split and curve that is very hard to extend to the theorems I want to discuss. So I will sacrifice some of the symmetries in exchange of the better ease generalization. Now, so the main point I want to check is that the sum of it can curve and the one operator, the low energy Lagrangian of the theories, really make manifest the estualities of the Cavallo theory. I want to have the estualities manifest and I want to see explicitly the parameter space of each couplings, still being of Q Cavallo of each couplings, instead of being just a product of a bunch of upcast planes, take the shape of this of the complex fraction of that space on a surface. So I will start with reviewing a few facts about the equation of the image theory that I'm accused of. So if I start with a naive supersymmetry algebra, okay, so in image of the theory, I will have two copies. The basic set of the supercharges, complex supercharges, in the form of quantum fields. For a total of A, a pair of supercharges. I want to sort of simply add that, which I even gave this for. Charges practice creation operators, nothing extraction operators, and I get a whole multiplet of massive particles which contain two to the. So if I have half of the particles as constructors, half of the charges constructors and half as characters, means that I get essentially two to the four states, multiples of two to the four states. More precisely, I get multiples of the four. If I take into account the spin, I get massive multiples of this form. But this is sort of the spin of the ground state, and this is the multiples created by the action of the construction operators. If my particle was massless, I cannot go to the rest of it. The best I can do is something like this. Now, the right hand side has four zero-even values, it's a projector. So, four supercharges will actually square to zero. And only that of, in the end that you have four can be split into constructors and structors. So I get an order of two, it is four states. And more precisely, I get some of this form. So if I take big G equal to zero, I get a complex hierarchy and a fermion. This is a one, which is called a half-elliptic multiplet. And take these and tensor by the sum is constant yesterday, the sum of expectations is constant of the gauge rule. If you take j equal to 1/2, it can expand the product. The left is being 1, which is a gauge field. With the the genus, and finally skill I think. Now plus minus one helicities and one scalar. And here is another scalar. So I get a gauge field, a complex scalar, and a bunch of fermions. And here I will denote the field as Q and Q there. The boson fields. Here is A mu and phi. And they all secretly join the gauge rule. Now, the Lagrangian and asymptotically free group. The Lagrangian for these fields is very easy to, it is rather easy to write down, and the conscious symmetry is very constrained. The kinetic term for the electron multiple state, you know, it must standard form. An interesting properties of potential, a sort of quality potential to the scales. And then the action of the movement involves another interesting topic. Different branches of water. You can either give expectation value to the upper multiplets, scalars, or you can give expectation value to the vector scalars. When you give expectation value to the hyper multiple scalars, you get a standard sort of fixed mechanism, meaning that some of the hyper multiples get eaten up by the vector multiples, which become massive. And this is so vector multiples plus hyper multiples combined with some massive representations of the symmetry algebra. On the other hand, if you move in the Coulomb branch, or the theory, which was like the sort of branch of path which I want to study today, you want to give expectation value to the vector multiple scalars. The vector multiple scalars have this potential, so you want to give expectation values. Where phi can be diagonalized, so the fact that the phi value is 0. If phi has a generic diagonal form, you see that all types of multiples will become massive. And also the orthogonal component of the scalar will become massive, the W bosons will become massive because of the usual X mechanism. And what you're left, the only massless fields you're left with are the essentially the diagonal components of the multiplets. So in that with the E1 to the run to the H2 abelian gauge theory. The important point is that no combination of multiplets has happened. This branch would exist even if you had no multiplets, if you were studying just pure gauge theory. So this Higgs mechanism must work out in a different fashion from the point of view of the supersymmetry algebra. You don't have any multiplets available to combine your massless vector multiplets into massive representations. Standard massive representations, because the massive representations have more components than your massless representations. Instead, what happens is that the commutator of supercharges really involves a gauge, closes up to a gauge transformation to a parameter phi. Actually, to be honest, parameter is phi bar, but usually phi is phi, doesn't matter. So, this means that if you're giving a expectation value to phi, if supercharges are acting on a charged particle, the gauge transformation will actually be non-trivial. We give you non-trivial things. So, the right hand side is actually non-zero. And instead, we have a constant central charge in there, which takes the form of QE of A. But QE are the electric charges under these U1 gauge fields. So they live in the carton of the gauge loop. And A's are the expectation values of phi, which also live in the carton of your gauge loop. Now, because of the modification of the supersymmetry algebra, the bounds of the mass for massive protected representations change. So now only if the mass is bigger than that to buy the central charge, you get a sort of log multiplets. Instead, if the mass equals that to buy the central charge, you still get a short multiplet for this form. Although now it's made of massive particles, mass absolute value z. But if you look at what the mass of W boson is, say, you do get things like absolute value of A1 minus A2 for something. And then F W boson will have charge 1 minus 1 under the U1s. So you're going to produce the statement that the mass of the W boson is an absolute value of central charge. And you understand why the W boson can remain in a short representation, seeing it massive. So this is an example of the big part. If the particles play a very important role in theory, the basic reason is that, for example, when you try to describe the energy dynamics of your theory, the first step you want to do is to integrate away all the massive particles in your theory. And it turns out that massive particle non-representations do not give any contribution to the loop calculation. Only the gas particles give a contribution, which I'll talk about in a moment. Now, there are other objects in the infrared, in the low energy theory, which can satisfy this sort of BPS bound and appear as protected particles in theory. Indeed, if you look at the classical field equations for the in the Coulomb branch, so if you give an object that is wide of infinity, you can find interesting solitons, smooth solitons, which carry magnetic charge and are a solution of your equations of motion, and there are supersymmetric solutions of your equation of motion. Because you can show that if you solve equations that form Fij equal to epsilon ijk jk phi, you will automatically solve the second order differential equations, and you will produce a smooth solution of the equations of motions, whose energy minimizes the energy among all the configurations with that fixed amount of magnetic or electric charge. So satisfies the PS bar. The only modification is that if your particles have a magnetic charge, you won't find another term here, where AB is just tau A. The reason you have this, you have tau entropy, the mass of one of the solitons, is that, there is a 1 over g squared in front of the action. So if you have a classical configuration, it will be weighted by, between an action and an energy, weighted by 1 over g squared, or more precisely by tau, if you take into account the time properly. Remember that tau was 4 pi I over g squared. Sorry, I guess I was calling 8 pi I squared plus theta root pi. Anyway, tau was the modification. Trying to remember. This is again the conventions with the 8 pi I or the 4 pi I. Just a moment. Two differences in the two papers are separated with them. So anyway, the proper way to say it would actually be that if you have the multiplets. So we said that you typically have phacosymmetric spatial-like multiples. At the very least, you have U1 for each set-like multiple. This can be enhanced to UN or SO2N or SP2N. So you have a mass parameter M, which lives in the Cartan, which lives in the algebra. And it issues an extra mass term in the Lagrangian that takes this form. So the notation should be clear. M acts is an end of the actual phacosymmetry. So symmetries act like multiples, like in this expression. So when it happens, you get an extra term in the central charge, so, which takes the form of QF. And QF is a. So once if you turn on this mass term, again you're breaking the phacosymmetry to an abelian subgroup. Which commute you then. So you have a set of abelian favor charges, and your central charge contains an extra term proportional to the diagonal components of M. Okay, these are the specific fact about the ultraviolet spectrum that you need. So classically, you have a single charge with a certain simple expression in terms of the excitation line of the diagonal components of phi of the mass terms, and ultraviolet value of the cuttings. And there is a biggest bound, and both the massive W bosons and the massive hyper multiples have such a biggest bound. And the next step will be to integrate them away to describe the low energy dynamics of the theory, of the remaining not massless, but being the theory. Now,
can you please remind how this last term transform and deploy? QF terms and.
Which is why?
This duality. You talked about this duality yesterday?
Yes.
And I'm just looking at Z and I was expecting it to be invariant.
No, but the question is not even. I mean, you cannot even ask the question. Because.
Can I apply
now,
it to any
so that's why it was taken about the conformative theories.
Oh, you have known.
Now I'm moving the Coulomb branch to the conformative theories. So there was a certain parameter specific to the subjects, and then I moved this some value of the Coulomb branch. Now, what does it mean to ask how does this quality actually see? You need to.
I was wrong. I thought that as duality acts on A and A, D.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Oh, okay.
Not at all. Because this duality.
Doesn't map electric into magnetic.
Not at all.
Okay.
Well, it does, but in not in the naive sense. So these are charges for the infrared theory.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, there is a three electromagnetic duality for this Abelian ring theory, under which these charges get mixed, and A and AD can get mixed. But it's not directly related to duality. Duality is just because, so duality is a statement that you have some moduli space tau, parameterized by tau, and you're relating two points in this moduli space. Now you're moving the Coulomb branch. And you need to tell me not just, you need to tell me which points in the Coulomb branch are you trying to compare, and which path are you using to compare them. So it's a. So there is a sense in which you can. There is really no canonical way to answer the pressure unless you specify the fact. But instead, the infrared electromagnetic duality of the Abelian ring theory definitely plays a very important role. So when you integrate away the massive particles of the original Lagrange, of the Lagrange Lagrange, such as bosons and multiples, you get a correction to the cuttings of your Abelian gauge theory. Now, the corrections are very constrained by the symmetry. So the infrared gauge theory is going to have some gauge cuttings, some measures of gauge cuttings, which is defined by saying that the kinetic time of the gauge fields take this form. And the constraints from supersymmetry tell that at all these cuttings can depend on the expectation values of the scalar field of the scalar fields. So again, I'm not sure I said it. So as I said, there is an Abelian Euler-Hartree theory with an equal true supersymmetry. the diagonal from point of phi has the super partners of the diagonal from points of the issues. So this A is clearly a sort of same sort of indices as the gauge field. So the construction of symmetry, the tau ij, is the second derivative. It can be written locally. It's the second derivative of the potential. Only the holomorphic function of the scalar fields. And if you integrate away one loop the massive particle of electric charge Q, QE, and you get a correction to the potential, which takes the form. So here Q was the charge of the particle you're going to get away. Z of Q, central charge. And the omega of Q counts the number of particles in the charge. So in terms of this J, first of all, it gives zero. You don't get any contributions from the long representations. And from every PTS particle, you get a contribution, which is essentially minus 1 to the 2j, 2j plus 1. Okay? So, in particular, we need to get away with the bosons. You get a contribution to tau ij, which takes this form. If you take away that boson of charge Q. This plus sign comes from this. It's crucial. So if your expectation takes this value for the scalar field, it's not very large. You get the imaginary part of tau is very large as well, and positive. So the infrared gauge theory is going to be decoupled. And you expect this, so you expect only weak coupled dynamics to be at work. Particularly, you expect more or less the description of the Coulomb branch in terms of the expectation part of the diagonal expectation value for phi and so on is good. But this A in that model. At some point, if A is small enough, the location starts getting negative. And tau, at the imaginary part of tau, it starts to become negative. So that's unphysical. Because the imaginary part of tau is in front of the kinetic tensor of all your radiations. So something must be happening. Something not there too, but it must be happening to make up for this. Now, the contribution from the multiplets. The contribution from that multiplets and don't put it sign. So if heavy enough matter, you can cure this problem, but what you're doing is you're just producing infrared free theory, which was not even asymptotically free. But if your theory was asymptotically free or home, and you had turned on mass parameters for your multiplets, then really nothing can save you. At some point, the phenomenon must kick in to save your to say like theory, So this is the only contribution to DAO, and there are no hybrid loop contributions. So the only contributions that are left are not automotive instance of contributions. The regular instance is strong coupling dynamics. So now I want to specialize on this to UNC2HQ, which was the first example that Simon Mitten dealt with. So the basic idea of Simon Mitten is that F and tau are locally holomorphic functions of your scalar field A. They have to have this behavior to infinity, but they have to cure the problems at small a. And often, these two constraints are sufficient to fix tau and f uniquely. Another point that I should make before I continue, another constraint for symmetry is that the BPS bound are not there. We still hold it, but in the implement. So Z will still be equal to QA plus QF dot AD plus QM dot AD plus QF dot M. The mass parameters are also allowed to enter. But now, two things happen. First of all, AD is not tau A anymore, rather ADI is the derivative of the potential with respect to I, so that tau IJ is the AD over the AJ. And furthermore, in general, you shouldn't parameterize the modelized space of marker by diagonal spatial values for phi, because that's not a really valid notion. Instead, you should use things like trace of phi to the n. Gauging band polynomials of phi. And then the A and AD, which appear inside the central charge, are not bound to coincide with the diagonal components of phi anymore. The statement will be true with coupling. So with coupling, A's will be, so that A's will have this interpretation, but you're not guaranteed that it will be true based on coupling. Okay. And what you want to find is tau A and AD is a function of these other parameters U, tau and tau for a function. So, curiously true. So yeah, if I can move to that, I only have one bit to move to that value that joint is true. And with coupling, I want to say that phi more or less is a minus diagonal components a minus a. So trace of phi squared, which I will denote as u, is approximately 2a squared. When I integrate the way the massive W boson using the expression over there, I get that it's very large A. Now we get like pi over pi. Pi over pi log of A to the fourth. Of a lambda to the 4th. So the factor of 4 becomes comes from the fact that the W boson has charge 2 in this with this normalization. The mass of the W boson is 2 in it. And so I have my A and AB, which are approximately square root of Euler 2 and square root of Euler 2. I have pi log of this square. Okay? And I would like to understand how to what sort of instanton protections should be added to make to give a physical value of tau on the U plane. So the moment the situation is that if I look at the U plane, there is a whole region of that stuff is happening. It's around the origin, which is the point where the W boson would have tried to become massless and the SU2 abelian would have liked to be restored classically. But it's a place where the one loop value of tau has a negative imaginary part. So, a piece of information which would be rather useful is that if you look at the classical monopole configurations in the ground, such that which is the mass of the configuration for the gauge fields, which go to this value of infinity, but really just means interior, and you quantize them semi-classically, you find a whole spectrum of interesting monopole and diode particles. So besides the W boson, which has zero magnetic charge and electric charge plus minus 2, you also have a bunch of monopoles and ions. Charges. So these are all these all things come from a semi-classical configuration of magnetic charge 1. When you quantize the zero modes, you see that these particles can also carry electric charge. So these guys should have mass AE plus 2NA. Now, suppose that for a moment I ignore the corrections and just look at how the mass of the model would behave from these expressions. Now, very naively, when u becomes a fourth of lambda squared, so the interaction ratio is 1, the logarithm is going to 0. So, very naively, it looks like at the boundary of this tangent region, there is a point where the magnetic monopole might become rather light, maybe even massless, definitely lighter than the W boson. And on the other side, when you use minus lambda squared, if that line is squared, then here you get 2 pi i, and you see that the particle charges 1, 2 might become very light in this region. So some of it then conjecture was that this is actually happening, that this monopole becoming massless at some point here, and this diode is becoming massless at some point here. So if that is happening, these particles are really much lighter than the mass of W boson. You should maybe not think in terms of having integrated away the W boson, but rather you should think in terms of having an integrated way, it's like monopole of life. Or if you want, you can ask for sort of singularity in the law of energy effective Lagrange, and you should see if a massless monopole appears in the spectrum. Because your massless Lagrange was only including the massless species, so if there is a massless part which you are ignoring, you should see a singularity. And so to study the effect of the mass of the light monopole, you cannot keep your so you want to essentially add it to the infrared Lagrange. But to add a monopole to the infrared Lagrange, you need to do an electromagnetic duality. Take a few strands into a light. So now you have magnetic gauge connection, which you can use to couple to gauge the fields of the light monopole. When you do this transformation to very much true infrared Lagrange, actually a lot of fun things happen. For tau, equals to minus one of tau, it's already just called tau d, tau dual, minus one of tau. And the role of tau of A is played now by AD. So you have a locally a dual tension, which is a function of AD. And A is minus DF D over DAD. So that tau D is minus one of tau is minus VA over DAD. And the Lagrange is completely invariant of the transformation. But Kovac, the only effect is the original potential in the place where the dual potential. This change of role between A and AE mimics the change of roles between electric and magnetic charges. So that the central charge, the expression of the central charge, after the things are affected. So, in particular, this means that in this region, where AD is going to zero, the molecules become massless, you expect to see the behavior of tau D that comes out of integrating away that light monopole. So, tau D should behave like minus pi over pi. So I think it's the function of two here. Sorry. Where AD plus 2A is going to 0, I get minus 1 over common of 2. It became like minus I over 2 pi logarithm AD plus 2A. Okay? So we predict that tau is going to 1, 2 to 0. And at this point, and tau is going to 2 at this point. Now, suppose we accept this conjecture for a moment. What are the consequences? Well, there is one first consequence which is actually pretty magical. So, if you look at the asymptotic expression for tau at large A, you would guess that if u goes to e to the 2 pi r u, which means that you're doing a hemotomy. Around the Ukraine. Because of the logarithm, tau will go to tau plus 4, and AD will go to AD plus 4A. Now, this compensates the fact that the charges of particles, the relative charges of ions, are shifted along the monotony by Wittgenstein's effect. Okay. So this monotomy was computed in weak coupling, was something we can trust. Now, on the other hand, because of these logarithms, I get some other monotomies that come out of these singular points. If I go around the singular point, minus 1 over tau goes to minus 1 over tau minus 1. While if I go around this singular point, I get minus 1 over tau minus 2 goes to minus 1 over tau minus 2 minus 1. Okay. Now, what's magical is that if I combine these two monotonies for these two particles, I actually recover the monotony at infinity. If I take tau, I do this transformation, and then this transformation, I recover tau of tau plus 4. In a sense, this really looks like a miracle. It's not something we put in. We had a very simple conjecture about the fact that we have certain particles kind of masses here and here. And magically, the monotony is induced by those massive particles, sort of resolve the monotony which was due to the originally to the presence of the mass of the standard boson. So this indicates that the original singularity of the boson was massless, which was creating all these problems, is actually not there physically. Instead, it's two singularities when I have multiples of different masses. And all that these singularities do is that they drive the coupling to be very strong, but still physical. And in a sense, this is a very strong indication that there should not be other singularities. Because if you add more singularities from other particles, other charges, it can be life. Well, good luck finding a combination of charges which should not modify the monotony to infinity. It's very, very hard, and might actually not be possible. So it's like a different equation.
Sorry, has it been proven then that, there are constraints, the number of singularities, right? I mean, if you say there are only two singularities, then
I don't know what is the minimum number of extra singularities you would need, without bothering the monotonies. I simply don't know it. I'm pretty sure that adding one or two or three is not gonna work.
Well, because by saying that, you don't want to keep those
essentially
necessarily.
You have a set of monotonies which are conjugated to T instead of set to Z. Mm-hmm. So it's something like G1, T, G1 to the minus 1, G2 to the minus 1, T, G2, G3 to the minus 1, T, G3. They want this to be the identity, so mm-hmm. they're not disturbing the monotony. So I don't know what the minimal solution of these problems.
But if you say only two, then there is a unique solution, because we pretty much have a good understanding why there can be only two. That's a supersymmetry breaking to n equal one. Strong indication.
That's right. There are also strong indications then.
Right. So my question is, if we assume that there are two, then
I think
the solution
is that it's much unique.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So now so So the main point now is that if I look for a function of tau of u with these discontinuities and the singularities, it's unique. And also if I look for functions a of u and a d of u, which have the expected asymptotic behavior under the singularities and these monotonies, they're also unique. So tau is actually pretty easy to see, in the sense that if you look at the group generated by these monotonies, one and it's actually it's a group that's called gamma 4 inside the SHZ. It's sort of the if the group of matrices of the form A, B, C, D, where B is convergent to 0 mod 4. You see, we're generating this group out of the monotony infinity and the monotony around the monotone form. This was the form. This was S. Yes. So, this map, you see the map from the U plane inside that graph plane divided by gamma 4. So if I take that graph plane and divide it by gamma 4, I get a nice modular region. So this side is identified with this side, and this side is identified with this side. And so the polar region is topologically, it's compact manifold, is a sphere with 3 points that move. One half of 0, one half of 2, one half of 1 infinity. We know where these 3 points are in the U plane. This was tied up to 0, tied up to 2, tied up to infinity. So we're trying to have an homomorphic map from the complex plane to the complex plane, which fixes the point that's unique. So how is unique? On the other hand, if I'm looking at A and AD, I can find the solutions for that geometric equation on the U plane. I can just set the geometric equation so that it has the correct monotonies, 0, here at 2 points and at infinity, you can set up a Riemann-Hilbert problem for this A and AD, requiring them for the correct monotonies, correct discontinuities, that singularities. And then you solve this Riemann-Hilbert problem just by constructing a differential equation for which whose solutions satisfy solve the same problem. This differential equation is an hypogeometric equation, which is rather easy to write down, but not very instructive. Now,
but it's not unique because there will be, but there is an additional assumption that goes in. You can construct a hypergeometric function that satisfies that, which would not modify uses the monodromies near the singularities. It will have simply more poles.
I'm saying the behavior of singularities and the monodromies.
Well, there is additional assumption. We can talk later, but the additional assumption is that there is an integer instanton expansion. So there are no...
No, I'm sorry. If I have a geometric function, I require this behavior.
Right.
And this behavior.
Right.
And I require this behavior.
So I'm saying if you have monodromes, there are monodromes, it's not enough. There are
monodromes. Yeah, the same as high monodromes and behavior.
So
the monotomies fix the rate.
You're fixing the rate. It doesn't have additional one over.
But this was physical data that I had available, so I perfectly free to use.
again, the physical data is a type of massless particles. Doesn't yes. necessarily.
Yes, it does. Once I know that there is a massless metal loop, the period can respond. I have nothing.
Yeah, I agree.
No. Now, Sarah Linden could have stopped here, and if they stopped here, nobody would have solved any issue when it got to one. Because the fact that this problem is sort of the problems are so constrained that it could be solved just by inspection. It's very special to the Jewish theory that we're going to see momentarily. So the Linden intuition was to express this data in terms of in very geometric terms, in terms of the curve. So they say, okay, if you're trying to find the tau value in that half plane, the value in the U plane, whose image lives in that half plane, the easiest way to describe such a tau is to construct an elliptic curve, a family of elliptic curves parameterized by U. And if I do that, automatically the period tau of these elliptic curves, the modulus tau of elliptic curves will live in that half plane. So, you want to have a map from U into some elliptic curve, E of tau. If you do that, you also get something else for free. The monotonies of, so this elliptic curve would have a bunch of, you know, two basic cycles, some A and B cycle. Okay? And these cycles will undergo monotonies so the way you get tau to have monotonies as a function of U is the elliptic curve becomes singular in its values of U. And the monotonies of the cycles of the elliptic curve actually reproduce the monotonies you want from A and AD. So, if you take the holomorphic differential on the curve, you get and you compute the integral of two cycles, you get two quantities which are such that the same monotonies in A and AD. And furthermore, the Bayesian ratio is tau. So this indicates that this should, I mean, there is a good chance that this will give you the A over the U and the AD over the U. I mean, at least if you analyze the differential property. But the ratio in the end in U and the AD over the U is tau. Now, so as I said, there is a unique map for the U plane tau, which means that it was actually known how to write down a very simple family of curves, which are these properties. So the curves look like this. Some numbers. So if I have an equation y squared equals the degree of the polynomial in z, that defines an elliptic curve. The holomorphic differential is written just as this e. The zero y. So now you can try to look at the periods of the differential along the common cycles of the curve and see if you can produce this asymptotic behavior. So you see at large U, the region of recapping, this term dominates the equation. So for most values of C away from 0 to infinity, this is the dominant term. y is approximately square root of 2u z. So if I just integrate over a cycle in the z-plane, z over y, not over 2 pi I, I will just get square root of 2u, 1 over square root of 2u. But this is a over the u. So I can factor twice. So the over the u is actually 1/2 of that, so it's a 4 pi. Okay. Now, what are the, if z is very small, then I can determine the zeros of this polynomial just by comparing these two terms. So I get an approximate zero at the lambda scale of u. And I get another approximate zero at the large at 2 yoga lambda square. So these are part of the lattice. So this polynomial has a 0 and 0. 0 very close at the underscore of 2u. And then another 0 very, very far at 2u on underscore. The period of the value is equal to 1, that the cycle corresponds to this cycle. We call it gamma electric, also giving us the electric A. And now you can look at the cycle of this form. Okay? We want to see if you can capture the logarithmic behavior of this period, a very large U. And the logarithmic behavior comes from this very long region in which this approximation is actually still good. And indeed, if you're integrating the Z over Z from here to here, you get something like log of 2u over lambda square minus log of lambda square over 2u. One half lambda square over 2u. So you see that you get you get approximately a log of u square over lambda square 4. So this cycle looks like that cycle where we integrate omega to get e and e over the u. And as u goes, become smaller, what happens is that these two zeros move in towards the middle. And they either meet directly, in which case the integral of this cycle becomes zero. This, you get this singularity. Or they meet after doing monotony, if you approach from this direction, in which case gamma magnetic plus 2 gamma electric. Becomes vanishing. So the equation seems to be very convenient to package the information of the solution for the theory. There's another object that's useful to introduce. Instead of, we'd like to be able to classify A and B as integrals of some from gamma electric and gamma magnetic, we can sort of integrate this equation by integrating all the respect to U. You get the lambda, and it's easy to see that lambda is just y the z over z squared. But if you do the derivative of y with respect to u, you get the 1/2 times 2z squared over y. And z squared cancel out. So this whole sub-Hermitian differential, and together with the sub-Hermitian curve, solves the theorem. Now, of course, what we wanted to understand was not pure SU2, but rather SU2 coupled to four hypermultiples, and then possibly all the complicated quivers. So, as an intermediate step, I would like to show you how the story gets modified if you couple the SU2 theory to a single mass, to a single hypermultiple. So if you look at SU2 and I think about 1. So now you get contribution tau both from the mass of the boson and from the mass of the hypermultiple. So the boson gives you the familiar pi over pi log of a to the 4 over lambda to the 4. And then you get the contribution from the hypermultiple, where the hypermultiple is really 2 half hypermultiples, but it's mass n, there with mass minus n. Okay. So you get the contribution of this form. Now, suppose I start from a situation where the mass might be multiple is very large. Much bigger than the scale at which don't have any effects kick in. Well, I'm going to get the singularity, so that this better and better multiple my multiple become massless is either m or minus n, which is u approximately m squared. So in your u plane, you expect to see a singularity at u equal to m squared, approximately b minus squared. Your hypermultiple is becoming your fundamental, the electrically charged hypermultiple you started with becoming very large. If you below that scale, you integrate away this field, and you expect to see the same structure of the previous two theory, two more similarities and corresponding discontinuities. As the mass, if you tune the mass to zero, the singularity will move in. Then you can actually, in the process, at some point, you'll actually cross one of the discontinuities, which means that the charges get attribute to it change. And you can get to a situation where you have just three more or less identical looking singularities. Now the magnetic monopoles of the theorem diagrams now have charge 1n instead of 1 to n. Basically because in the background of the monopole you get some Fermionic zeromorphs, but I can multiply. You need to quantize them, and the effect is the magnetic monopoles can carry some of the charges of your hypermultiples. So in particular some of these guys can carry thermal charges, but of course you see them suppressing thermal charges in the monopole. So okay. Anyway, you might imagine now trying to solve the problem the same way as before, trying to set up the remarkable problem for A and B, or trying to reconstruct now from this simple feature, replace singularities in the play. But you get into a little bit of trouble. For example, if you try to write down differential equations for A and B, I have three singularities. You need to use a generalized geometric equations, which give you solution to three singularities. Now, it turns out that when you write down the differential equation, you try to impose certain monotonies. Basically, you can do is to fix the conjugacy class of your monotonies, your singularities. Now, if I had only two singularities and one at infinity, and I require the product of monotonies to be one, fixing the conjugacy class is sufficient to fix the actual monotony matrices. But if you have three singularities, that's not the case, and there is one extra degree of freedom. So even if you impose the power of monotonies as one and impose the conjugacy class of the columns, you're left one degree of freedom. Correspondingly, the differential equation you apply has a free parameter inside, which is not fixed in terms of the conjugacy classes. Now, and relating, so fixing this free parameter in such a way that your monotony take the expected form is a very hard problem. Instead, the way used to solve this problem is just to look for an appropriate family of elliptic curves as a function of u, which becomes singular at three locations and give you the correct monotonies. And, probably alluded to it, but in the curves are true, but let me repeat it. If your elliptic curve, if you in the monotonic space, you have a place where the elliptic curve has nice stable singularity, where one cycle, gamma 1, shrinks down. The other cycles, if you do monotony around the singular point, the other cycles are subject to very simple less monotony called. So this is the intersection number in the two cycles. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the logarithmic behavior at singularities due to a master set of multiplets, you see that the charges of particles are subject to. They have the same monotony with the same structure with QQ1 is defined as Q electric 1, Q magnetic 1 minus Q magnetic Q electric 1. So if I'm in front of it. So this means that if you find a family of elliptic curves with the correct singularities, it will automatically give the correct monotonies to an A and an E, defined as integrals of the Bayesian cycles of the homomorphic of, let's say, the A over the U and the AD over the U. If you find a family of elliptic curves, you get L to go for 3. Now, when you buy the natural plane, you have the correct behavior of all the theories around the singularities. And all you have to ensure that the monotonies are working out, which means that as a function of u, you're going to get singularities indeed at this point, and that the monotony at infinity, the singularity at infinity, has the correct shape. And a hint is that as the mass goes to infinity, you should recover the curve of QSU. There are a lot of hints, and it's rather simple to write down a curve. So again, as u is much bigger than lambda squared, and the mass bigger than lambda, you have a situation where all the zeros of your polynomial are either at very small values of z or at very large values of z. And there is an isolated cycle which if that's the sacrifice, absolutely is g equals 1. You need to integrate omega always to 0 to y for the disciple. It produces expected behavior of the square root of u at infinity. For disciple, there are two singularities of 0. The two zeros, small c, and one at infinity, which are exactly square root of u over lambda. That's minus square root of u over lambda. Or lambda squared. And if you evaluate the integral of the zero over y over this period, lambda squared over u. That's u over lambda squared. See, the location of the zero at lambda g, you get by comparing the two terms. The location of the zero of that small z by comparing these terms. So you see that you get the quadratic equation. You get the square root of e, 1 over u. So now if you compute this integral, you get a logarithmic piece, looks like log u, but then a half log u. So instead of getting a log of u squared, you get log of e to the 3 half, which is exactly the integral of this at large a. So to have 4 minus 1 half minus 1 half is 3. And you can do it. And furthermore, if you look at the singularities at finite u, well, you get one where these two guys hit each other, which was this singularity. And then you get singularities where now these two guys hit the other one, the zero, at a very far away. So you get these two singularities. Okay. I'm sorry for shrinking up the story a little bit, but I was for this. Now, I could continue reviewing the construction of Sagan and Witten. So they gave the curve for an ethical to 1, 2, 3, and 4. But there is a little problem with the strategy. Let me just jump to a situation if you want to form. So, Sagan and Witten write down a very nice neat curve for the form y squared equal to a polynomial of integrate v in z, which is also a polynomial in u and a function of the masses. Remember, these masses live in the Cartan. Of SOA. And if you want to have a manifest SOA symmetry, you should only see the cosiness of this SOA. So the cosiness look like sum of MA squared, sum of MA to the 4, sum of MA to the 6, very happy. And sum of MA to the 8. But really, there is a path that is into the product of the MA. Okay? And, Now, there is a point I should have made here. Let's make it now. So here I gave you omega, the zero to y. If I take this omega into a lambda, that will give you just a and a's and not the derivatives. Well, that's pretty easy. The reason it's easy is because u is appearing linearly here. So if you want to, if I write something like lambda equal to y to z over z squared, and I do the derivative respect to u. Omega. Okay. Notice, in particular, I can rewrite the subwritten curve in a very neat form as lambda squared equals to the z squared over z squared, lambda squared over lambda squared z, sorry. Yes. Plus 2u plus 2 lambda m over z plus lambda squared over z squared. This form is very neat because it shows you that very large u and this time dominate. Lambda does behave as square root of u of the 0 and z, which is what we need to get an a, which behaves like square root of u and 2. Square root of 2. The basic property of this lambda is that if I compare it to the lambda of the pure sexual theory, and I look at the behavior at infinity at zero, I get lambda is approximately lambda capital lambda over c squared plus m over t plus dot mods. So lambda is a Hessian unit at zero with coefficient m. So what it means that when I do these integrals to read off a and ad, I should be careful because besides the cards, apart from the square root cards in lambda at this value plus minus lambda square over u, I also have an residue at zero. So that actually makes a difference to close my cycle around this. On one side or the other of the origin. This simply coincides with the fact that my central charge was QE A plus QM AE plus QF. So if I want, so the correct statement I should write down is the integral of lambda on some cycle gives me the central charge corresponding to the charge, to the first charge. So the integral of lambda along some cycle will get some extra contributions from this residue, from the residue of lambda zero, which give you multiples of the master. So you really see that the mass enter the definition of central charges. Now, the main problem of this beautiful expression of subwritten is that it's very hard to write down lambda. There's no problem writing down omega. But this polynomial is actually cubic in U. You can make it quadratic with a little shift, but you cannot make it linear in U. So if you try to integrate omega with respect to U to get lambda, you get a very complicated function with arc sine logarithms and stuff. That's not very nice. It had to be a complicated expression just because if the mass parameters, so you can show the mass parameters, so the mass parameters had to be entered as residues of lambda at some singular points. But only subwritten only allow the Cartans to enter in the equation. So there is just no way to rewrite this as a simple polynomial equation in lambda. The best I could do would be a degree 8. So I want lambda to behave like an A over Z minus ZA, some patients. But this, I'll allow myself to write equations in which the NAs appear in this form. it is to show that I had to write down equations so for lambda to the 8 plus something lambda to the 6 plus something lambda to the 4 plus the plots, which is rather ugly. And moreover, an equation like this will never look like, and it will be very easy to make this into a curve, an equation for an elliptic curve. Like this is a very high degree polynomial lambda, it is, even if it is a polynomial to C, I'm going to get maybe the curve of very high genus, but they said I just things to use extra singularities. So it looks like if you want to preserve the whole SOA perosymmetric manifest, you will not be able to write an easy, a simple expression for lambda. Now, if you remember from yesterday, we don't actually care about having the full SOA symmetry manifest. What we really want to have is to have those four SU2 subgroups inside the SOA, which we're going to use later, which are going to gauge later to produce more interesting features and quivers. So instead of having this curve, I would like to have a different description of the curve and the target differential, which only cares about information of the SU2 focus symmetries. Now, to do that, interesting. And it's very, very, I mean, I'm not aware of any way to rewrite the curve directly in the form I want. So, in principle, it's some complicated transformation of Y and Z to such variables of isogeny, but and I don't know what the correct isogeny is. Instead, I will just try to write down a curve with the correct properties and check if it works. So, what I want is an equation of this form, lambda squared equals some function of z. Okay? Because lambda is a null form, lambda squared would be what's called a quadratic differential. So I want it to be some rational function of z that is squared. So these are the quadratic differentials I was getting for pure SU2, SU2 and F equal to 1. Furthermore, I want to see the mass terms for the value SU2s. Appear properly. Now, mass terms give you the Cartan, so I want to see residues proportional to set A's at various points on the curve. And I want only n squared, which is the Casimir, as you should, top here in the curve, because I do want to have an explicit SU2 frequency, not just B1. So the easiest way to get this behavior is to require one squared to have a double pole. And 4 points. The ones that choose the crazy four, with residue and a squared. If I do that, lambda itself will automatically have the correct residues to interpret as mass terms of an SU2 ferrosymmetry. Now, once I put a double pole, I should also allow myself a single pole. And, the simplest thing I can try to do is just not to have other singularities. just to take these as a form of my lambda squared. I will only have to adjust the coefficient CA so that I don't have an extra, I don't get an extra singularity at infinity. If I want the Poisson differential to be smooth at infinity, I want it to behave as the z squared or z to the fourth. So that if I do z to 1 over z, to bring infinity to zero, I get something that's constant there. So what I evolved behaves like 1 over z. So I need to keep the coefficient of 1 over z, 1 over z squared, 1 over z cubed. So after the four CAs, I only have a single degree of freedom. So in general, my lambda squared will take the form of some polynomial, some definite polynomial, the correct quadratic. Which gives me the correct residues plus a degree of freedom, U. Which, as you can guess, I want to ultimately identify with the U parameter of my H6-Schubert theorem. Okay. Now, I picked four points on the sphere. Each associated with a certain H6 mass parameter, which is a certain H6-Schubert symmetry. Now, this should remind you of the pictures I was drawing yesterday. Okay? So, now the period, if I compute the period of lambda, so here I just pick a certain coordinate system of sphere, can pick any other coordinate system, can do any fractional transformation without changing anything. So I could set my ZAs to be 0, 1, U, infinity. Or if you prefer, the only combination of the ZAs that actually enter the periods of lambda is the cross ratio. In this four points on the sphere. And, intuitively, I might imagine that this cross ratio has something to do with the gauge coupling of our theory, or better, if this has to be the semi-limited curve of Q2 and F equal to 4, the ultraviolet gauge coupling should enter somewhere in the equation, and the only three parameter I'm left here, besides the zero, which is dimensionless, the only dimensionless parameter I'm left with is really the cross ratio. The definition is 4 points. So, with this in mind, I may ask what happens if I explore extreme values of this space. So, this point, at the moment, I see a parameter space for this subgroup curve, which is parameterized by Q, and something interesting must happen when this Q gets close to 0, 1, and infinity. So say that I look at Q, I get to flat up here. Yes, sorry. I don't want to hide that. I thought I was working on intermediate flat up. So, suppose I take Q to be much bigger than 1. So my 4 points on the sphere are getting close in pairs. So let me use a coordinate system where these points are being getting close in pairs, meaning that these are, say, 0, root of Q, 1 over root of Q, root of Q, infinity. Okay? So I had this expression. I'm sending this. I'm taking this limit. You know, lambda had a simple poles, zero at these 2 points, and simple poles at these 2 points, and I said these 2 points will be very close to each other, unless I do something fancy with mass parameters, which I don't want to do. The constant, of course. Then lambda will keep having a simple pole here and here. So I can write an approximate expression for lambda in this region in terms of this coordinate system C. Lambda squared, we have a double pole at zero, double pole at infinity, so it's essentially fixed in this form for some u. This u will be a linear combination of this capital U, plus possibly some linear combination of the mass squared. That's why I will call it little u instead of capital U. And it might differ by this capital U by some function of people that's little q. So in particular now, I can integrate lambda over this cycle gamma electric, and I get approximately equivalent, say 2u, square root of 2u. Okay, so this is the correct behavior for the correct relation between A and U at variable coupling. So I have notice that here now I really have a weak. I have a gauge coupling to Tavares, I can make that gauge coupling weak. So on the other hand, so in particular, this shows you that if lambda squared had zeros, they are leading pretty close. So lambda squared had 4 zeros now. They must be leading pretty close to the poles. Now I can zoom in a different way. I can put a point at 0, 1 at 1, and the others at infinity in Q. Okay? Now, lambda squared has double poles at 0, 1 at approximately infinity. I can again write it down. Sure that the residue at 0 is m1 squared. That's the coefficient of z minus 1 squared is m2 squared. And I only have a double pole at infinity. I identify this little u with this little u just because I can read off this electric cycle here, the same as the electric cycle here. It reads off the residue of lambda at infinity, which was square root of u. So, now, what the numerator, what are the zeros of lambda squared? Well, it's a little, takes only a little bit of algebra to show that they are at u equal to m1 plus minus m2 squared. Sorry, I said one. So there are two zeros. This is a, if I collect everything together, I get a polynomial of degree 2 upstairs over z squared, z minus 1 squared. So there are two zeros. If I look at the values of u, such as two zeros for y, and I get a singularity in the u plane, it happens when u is equal to m1 plus minus m2 squared. So this is exactly the singularity which I would associate to like multiplets with masses m1 plus m2, or m1 minus m2. But if you remember the way these SU2A and SU2B were embedded in SU8, this was just SU2 times SU2, SU2 times SU2 was SU4. And A and B So the eigen values, the Cartan of SO4 has eigen values in A plus minus in B. So my electro multiples I put in the Lagrange are having B masses, 1 plus minus 2. So this is good. It means that, and I can repeat the same exercise, zooming in on infinity, sending the other points at zero in one over two. And then I will find other singularities as u approximately equal to n p plus minus n 4. I should clearly call this n a, b, c, and d, sorry. So I have a neat picture of the u plane in this limit. I have the expected singularities, which is the mass is not pretty large, far away in the u-plane. And they clearly correspond to the length of multiples I took in Lagrange. And then you can also show that if you now take u mass, you can show with a little bit more effort that you still have the other two singularities which you associate to pure SU2. I mean, if you go at scale is much lower than the mass of the other multiples you had added. So if you take u much smaller than the masses, then in this picture, actually one of the zeros starts moving in. And the other zero starts moving in. In a sense, this quadratic differential here goes to the quadratic differential of pure SU2 in a very straightforward manner. So I'm sort of scaling the masses to be very large compared to u. So I'm sending in two double poles together while tuning the coefficient to be very large. If I do that, I can actually get a triple pole, which is what SU2 in n equal to 0 had. And so I can get, so what's happening is that one of the zeros is going in together with two poles, two double poles, give a triple pole, and the other zero is remaining behind. And now you have singularity, so these two zeros which are left behind at me. Sorry about that. So I did pretty much for time, so I don't want to spend more time with this algebra. But so I just wanted to argue that all the basic tests for these curves are passed. So it does have correct behavior in a recapping limit. It gives you the correct number of singularities in the U-plane, which you could compare with the n equal 1 deformation of the theory. Furthermore, now of course this was only one of the tasks in the parameter space of Q. So that was the three tasks, Q goes to infinity, Q goes to 1, Q goes to 0. And of course when you look at these three tasks, different pairs of points, different pairs of double poles are colliding together. So instead of finding light particles of masses A and A plus minus B squared, you'd find light particles of masses M A plus minus MC on M A plus minus MB squared. So you really see that you have a SL2Z, you have a parameter space with three tasks, where states leaving AB, AS, and AC are present. So you need to cover the picture we had yesterday. Finally, if you simply now compute the integral of lambda on the magnetic cycle, you get that AD is approximately K log Q. There was a coefficient, right? Well, I'm not sure I'm getting. So there's a coefficient here. So the point is that Q, if I define it into the I tau havara. Okay. So this is the same relation that we were seeing yesterday when we were ascending a four bunch of spheres out of two, three bunch of spheres. Okay. Now, so at this point you can easily guess what should be the subalpitan curve for a generic theory in the class discussed yesterday.
Sorry, but this was not subalpitan curve.
Yeah.
It was
subalpitan curve.
I thought it was a elliptic curve, and you got spheres for points.
Well, look, you can just define something like. No. The spherical for points is not the curve. The curve is this equation, which is a ramified cover of the. It's a ramified double cover of the sphere. It ramifies on the zeros of lambda squared, and there are four such zeros. If you want to write the curve in a slightly more familiar way, you could try to write lambda as the c y over all out of z minus z a, okay? Then you get something like y squared equal to a polynomial of degree 4 z. So you recover the elliptic curve. I don't know what is the correct isogeny to go from this elliptic curve to the elliptic curve is submitted by gamma. It's presumably going to be rather complicated because this object is linear in the masses squared, but the ones they had is degree 6 in the masses. But I'd be actually quite curious to see such transformation. But it satisfies the same tests that Saber and Witten subjected their curve to. So,
but when did you say that tau ultraviolet is not related to tau of the Witten?
Oh, that was that's very well known, that the tau ultraviolet and the tau infrared are actually not identical. So, U is something like theta, in any case, theta 2 to the 4th over theta 3 to the 4th of tau infrared. I mean, if you define tau infrared as A over AD, in the limit where the masses are set to 0, A over AD. If you send masses to 0, you just get something like U over.
No, but how do you see this relation? You just see that this is the Zeigler-Witten curve, and you compute tau Zeigler-Witten from that and see this complicated expression. Does it make sense?
Which complicated expression?
Q as a function in terms of theta.
No, I see this. So, I will copy, I recover this relation. Now, instead you can do something else, which is sending the masses to zero so that you go back to the conformal point. You can look at if the tau of the... I mean, if you wanted to embed the parameter space of Q inside a Hausdorff plane, then this is the sort of expression you can use. Anyway, I want to write down a certain curve for the family of theories. It's that different. Well, it's not that easy to guess. It's under square root if I chose E. If I chose E, the marginal differential, it behaves like MA squared over Z and C squared. This is squared. And these are the functions on the regular surface. C. So remember, we had a regular surface Gn associated with the theory of G of Gn. Conjecture that the subalpitan curve for this theory, for this class of theories, coincides with double over the regular surface. Defined by this equation. which is constraints. You see, if you fix the double false, what you're left is a parametric space of parametric differentials with simple false and functors on the systemic surface of G. And there are 3G minus 3 plus n parametric differentials. Simple poles. And remember our theory TGN that the G minus K plus N is usual. So if you have 3G minus K plus N over the parameters, which identify this parametric differential of the simple poles. So the basic match of degrees of freedom is working. So we have enough degrees of freedom in position of the points on the structure parameters of the same surface to encode all the UV couplings of your theory. You have enough parameters in your subject curve to encode all the orbital parameters. Furthermore, if you look at the lattice of cycles in this curve, so if you look at all the possible independent values of the integral of lambda over the cycle in this curve, you get a bunch of A's and A's, and you get the correct number. Furthermore, whenever you consider a weak coupling limit of the theory, which yesterday identified the situation where all the cubes in your Riemann surface are becoming thin. Something like this. You can always consider sort of zooming back in this region. Say we're zooming here. You are over an electric cycle. To measure the A of the gauge group which is becoming really coupled. And in a sense that the subject and curve behaves under this weight weak coupling limits exactly the way it should. So the subnewtonian curve for this theory, if this coupling becomes weak, reduces to the total of the Newtonian curve for these two theories, together with a little bit of information about the handle, from the handle, which is called the property of the weakly coupled SU-Schubert theory. So essentially, all the manipulations I did here on the first sphere can be repeated easily on this more complicated stuff. And so you can verify the logarithmic part in the Friedrich couplings correspond to the one loop corrections from the bunch of fundamental hypermultiples, so for the function of position and for the fundamental bosons, so on and so forth. So all sorts of tests that you could do for SU and SU 4 can be repeated there without much more work. And so, it is a reasonable conjecture this is the correct subject curve for this theory. Actually, it's even stronger because now you have this network of relations for weak coupling limits that constrains you and this passes all the tests. You verify the parameter space of gauge couplings into the parallel theory can really be identified with the modular space of complex structures for Riemann surface. This uses the correct curve for the theory built out of these two gauge groups. We can also easily write down candidate curves for the theory built out of these three gauge groups and E6 theories, for example. So we write things like lambda Q plus phi Schu, plus C, lambda plus psi phi of z equal to 0. Remember, these fields were labeled by Hamer surfaces. Big hundreds of true dives. So, there is a very simple prescription for the poles of phi 2 and phi 3, so that this cyclic curve is the correct opposite expected from respective fields. Essentially, and this generalizes to essentially like to hydrogen, for strange theories or words. So the all sort of techniques of theories which were discussed yesterday, the very simple low energy description in terms of these subalbitian curves, whether the subalbitian differential is a very simple form. Any questions? That's the thankful line.